Our democracy is hanging by a thread, but we know it's not about just winning and losing each battle. It's about persistence and building resilience.
That's why we're launching the Practivist Pod, the practice of activism made practical.
If you're looking for ways to get engaged or just for ways to stay sane, we want to help you navigate what comes next.
It's an exciting collaboration with political dynamo Jess Craven, author of the Chop Wood, Carry Water newsletter,
and grassroots activist Steve Pearson, host of the How We Win podcast.
Every week on the Practivist Pod, we're going to have important conversations with changemakers, give you practical ways to make an impact, have some fun, and inspire hope.
This is more than a podcast. It's a place for our community to grow our practice of advocacy for justice, equity, and progress.
Action is the best antidote for anxiety. So subscribe to the Practivist Pod today.
Our press secretary gave alternative facts to that.
My goal in this deposition was to be truthful, but not particularly helpful.
Welcome to Unspun, the podcast that makes you better at finding the truth. The way people get news is changing. It used to be that there were many reporters who would research stories and write articles, but now politicians and famous people share information directly with you on social media and the internet. That means you find out things fast, but it's up to you to make sure the information's actually accurate. And newsmakers don't always do their part. The temptation to manipulate information is strong. They bend the truth to deceive so that they can avoid accountability, so that they can advance their agendas. When you recognize these agendas, you can sometimes find out what's real. And we're at a crossroads where anyone can share anything online, so it's important to sharpen your critical thinking skills. Finding that deception before it goes viral is pretty much a survival skill now, and we're going to do it together. Let's get unspun.
Hello, Truth Seekers, and welcome to this week's episode of Unspun. You can think of this week's episode as a follow-up to episode 35, which was about the role of journalism in a democracy. In that episode, we learned that one of the big roles of journalism is just informing the public. People have to have a shared reality in order to work together to create the life that they want, and journalism helps everybody to know what's going on. We also learned that it was important for journalists to hold power accountable and to provide a platform for different perspectives so people can talk about important issues. Overall, in a democracy, journalism empowers the citizens. It gives them information, and it gives them a voice. And really, democracy can't exist without it. Today, I want to think about the role of journalism from other types of government. So I'll be doing that. Sound good? Let's get unspun. Let's start with this clip from a White House press availability.
We have this unelected fourth unconstitutional branch of government, which is the bureaucracy, which has, in a lot of ways, currently more power than any elected representative. And this is not something that people want, and it does not match the will of the people. So it's just something we've got to fix. And then we've also got to address the deficit.
That was tech mogul and special government employee Elon Musk speaking to the press inside the Oval Office with both his four-year-old son and the President of the United States, Donald Trump, in attendance. In case you've been avoiding the news for the last month, Musk is working with a rebranded government agency called the Department of Government Efficiency, and that department has been visiting and collecting data from many existing government agencies. Musk uses a word here that I think we could benefit from understanding a little bit better, bureaucracy. It's something we've all encountered, but might not fully understand. And I know the word itself doesn't exactly scream excitement. You know, it probably makes you think of endless paperwork and long lines at the DMV or sitting on hold for what feels like forever. But bureaucracy is more than just a headache. It's a system. And it plays a huge role in how organizations, governments, and even whole societies work. So what exactly is bureaucracy? At its core, it's a way of organizing people and processes to get things done efficiently, at least in theory. You can think about a big organization, like a government agency or a corporation. There's a ton of things they have to do, a bunch of rules they have to follow, and people they need to manage. A bureaucracy creates a structure to handle all of that. It's like the operating system of an organization. It lays out who does what, how decisions are made, and how information flows. The idea of bureaucracy as we know it today comes from a sociologist named Max Weber, who studied how societies organize themselves. And Weber described bureaucracy as a system based on things like clear rules, specific job roles, a hierarchy of authority, and an emphasis on impartiality. In other words, it's a system where decisions are made according to the rules, not by personal relationships or emotions. So let's break that down. Imagine you're applying for a driver's license. The process is the same for everyone. Fill out this form, take that test, pay this fee. It doesn't matter who you are or who you know, the system's designed to treat everyone equally. And that's the ideal of bureaucracy: fairness, consistency, and efficiency. So what Elon Musk is alleging is that bureaucracy actually has more power than the elected officials do. And I feel like I should say at this point that Elon Musk speaking on the perils of unelected people while unelected himself is a bit ironic. Let's start by taking a journey back in time to understand how bureaucracy came to be what it is today. Because believe it or not, there's a pretty interesting history. So picture this. It's the early 1800s, and the U.S. government operates under what's known as a spoils system. Here's how it worked. If you supported the right politician during an election, you could land yourself a cushy government job, even if you had no qualifications. And we see a little bit of a legacy of this today with people who are selected as ambassadors. So, you know, you might have a local shopkeeper and he helps campaign for the winning presidential candidate. And after that election, that shopkeeper might get a job as the local postmaster. Sounds nice, right? For him, anyway. The problem was that these appointments had little to do with someone's skills, and it had everything to do with political loyalty. So what ended up was a very inefficient and corrupt government. You know, imagine a customs office staffed by people who don't know the first thing about tariffs or trade, or a local government office run by someone who couldn't even balance a budget. The system was chaotic, and the services to the public really suffered as a result. Now fast forward to the Civil War era, and people are fed up. The inefficiency and corruption of the spoils system had reached a breaking point by the end of the war, and there were loud calls for reform, especially after the assassination of President James Garfield in 1881. Garfield was assassinated by James Guiteau, and Guiteau believed he had played a significant part in helping Garfield get elected in 1880, but his actual contribution was tiny. He had written a speech called Garfield vs. Hancock Supporting Garfield, but it was not very well written, and it had little to no impact on the campaign. Guiteau printed a few copies of the speech, and he distributed them to a small audience, but it was mostly unnoticed and unremarkable. But despite this, Guiteau convinced himself that his speech had been decisive in Garfield's win, and so he deserved a reward for his service. He asked for a government appointment, particularly the position of U.S. consul in Paris, and he was ignored, and this made him angry. So, at the time, the government operated under that spoils system where political supporters would usually get jobs. Garfield himself leaned toward reforming the system, which created some tension within the Republican Party. And Guiteau believed that killing Garfield would unify the party and elevate his own status. So on July 2nd, he shot Garfield at the Baltimore and Potomac Railroad Station in D.C. Garfield actually survived the shooting, but he died 79 days later because of infection. Guiteau was arrested on the spot, and he was later executed in 1882. His actions, though, did make people pay attention to the weakness of the spoils system, and it became a catalyst for civil service reform, which eventually became the Pendleton Act of 1883. And this act is still in use today. It introduced merit-based hiring for federal employees. Among other things, the act created a federal civil service system, where government jobs were now awarded based on competitive exams, not just your political connections. And it also made it illegal to fire or demote employees for political reasons. For the first time, people were getting jobs because they were qualified, not because they had political clout. And then came the 1930s. It was a decade that completely transformed the role of bureaucracy. You know, the country was in the grips of the Great Depression, and millions of Americans were out of work. So the federal government, under President Franklin D. Roosevelt, responded with the New Deal. This was an enormous suite of programs and reforms that were designed to stabilize the economy and help struggling Americans. A new wave of federal agencies sprang up, each one designed to address specific issues. So there was the Civilian Conservation Corps, which put unemployed young men to work on environmental projects. There was the Tennessee Valley Authority, which built dams and brought electricity to rural areas. The Securities and Exchange Commission was established to regulate the stock market and prevent another Wall Street crash. These agencies didn't just enforce laws, they regulated whole industries from banking to agriculture. As the government grew, it expanded its role in the economy and the power of the bureaucracy grew a lot. For the first time, Americans saw bureaucracy not just as government policies, but as a central player in the nation's present and future. So, what exactly is a bureaucracy and how does it work? At its core, a bureaucracy is a system that's designed to put public policy into action. It's the machinery that keeps governments and other large organizations running. But to really understand it, we need to look at the key features of how they function. First, there's hierarchical structure. So bureaucracies are like pyramids with a clear chain of command. Decisions flow from the top down, and every level has specific responsibilities. Sort of like a ladder, right? Each rung represents a different level of authority. And then there's the concept of official duties. Bureaucracies sort themselves around clearly defined roles and rules to determine the authority to carry out those roles. Everything is structured to ensure consistency and order. And speaking of rules, access to positions in a bureaucracy is rule-based. Unlike in a legislature where elections determine who gets a seat, bureaucratic roles are filled through hiring processes, which are usually based on qualification. It's meant to be impartial, but it's not always perfect. The rulemaking process is another key part of how bureaucracies operate, and it involves several steps. Establishing laws, which gives the bureaucracy the authority to enact them, this is usually done by the legislative branch. Developing specific rules and policies for how that action will happen. Implementing those rules. And finally, settling disputes or making decisions about how the rules are applied. Government bureaucracies face unique constraints that don't apply to private organizations because they have to work within strict limits on how they use labor and resources, and they're subject to layers of oversight and accountability. There are bureaucracies that combine legislative, executive, and judicial powers within a single institution, and that can make them really efficient or it can make them really frustrating depending on how well they operate. Because not all bureaucracies are created equal. There's several types. You can find them all even in a single government, and they differ based on how they approach making the laws happen, which means actually enacting them for the citizens. Production agencies have clear goals and measurable methods, so it's easy to define success, and I think the U.S. Postal Service can be an example, right? Their goal is simple, deliver mail and packages efficiently, and you can measure their success by metrics like delivery speed, accuracy, maybe customer satisfaction. So, for example, if your small town's hit by a snowstorm and the roads are blocked, the Postal Service has one clear job, do the mail. So they deploy snowplows, they reroute trucks, and they prioritize emergency routes, trying to get mail to every mailbox because their goal is easy to define and their success is measured by how quickly the mail gets through despite the bad weather. In a craft agency, outcomes are easier to measure than specific methods used to achieve them. So NASA could be an example of this. Let's say they want to land a rover on Mars, but they hit a snag. So maybe a key piece of the technology malfunctions when they test it. The engineers and the scientists are going to brainstorm solutions. They're going to try different approaches until they find one that works. The outcome, you know, landing the rover on Mars, is what defines success, but the exact path to get there is going to involve trial and error and creativity. So that's a craft agency. A procedural agency has difficult-to-measure goals using standardized procedures, and I think the DMV could be an example of this. So for the DMV, the goal is to ensure that all the drivers are qualified and licensed. And that might be hard to measure, at least the qualification part. So they focus on following a standardized process, right? They give you a vision test, they give you a written exam, they give you a road test. If a teenager comes to the DMV to get their first driver's license, the DMV employee doesn't personally evaluate whether they're going to be a safe driver in the future because you can't really do that. So instead, they follow the process. They check the documents, they administer the test, they issue the license if they pass the test. So their success is measured by following their procedure, not by predicting the future accurately. And finally, there are coping agencies like Child Protective Services, for example. They deal with really ambiguous outcomes, and their methods are also uncertain. They exist in a lot of the gray areas. So, for example, if Child Protective Services is called to investigate a report of neglect, a coworker might visit the home, and the situation could be really complex. So, for example, the parents could be struggling financially, but they are trying to provide for their children. And so the social worker has to decide whether they should take the children away, should they offer the family support services, should they monitor the situation to make sure it gets better? And there's not really a clear-cut formula for success here because every decision is going to come with certain risks. So each of those types of bureaucracy has its own challenges, but all of them play a critical role in implementing policy. And of course, they have flaws. One major criticism of bureaucracy is that decision-making can sometimes reflect the interests of a select few rather than the broader public. This is where something called an iron triangle comes into play. This is a tight relationship between bureaucrats, politicians, and private interest groups that can lead to something that they call rent-seeking behavior. Here's an example of how this might work. Imagine a large defense contractor that specializes in building military aircraft sees a chance to profit by lobbying the national government to fund a new fighter jet program. So here's the catch, though. The military doesn't actually need a new fighter jet. You know, their existing planes still work. And experts are arguing that the resources would be better spent on cybersecurity or modernizing equipment they already have. But the defense contractor is well connected. So it spends millions of dollars lobbying lawmakers in Congress, particularly those whose districts rely on defense jobs. They emphasize the economic benefits of the program. You know, this will create thousands of jobs in your constituency. They maybe make large campaign contributions to influence politicians to support increased defense spending. And eventually the government approves the program, so they allocate billions of dollars to develop the new fighter jet. The defense contractor gets a huge payday, and it does create some jobs, but what's the cost? The funding for a program like this comes at the expense of other priorities like education, infrastructure, healthcare. And in the end, the new fighter jet wasn't even really needed. The defense contractor didn't create any new value for society. It used its influence to secure government funding for a project that primarily benefits itself. The taxpayers are footing the bill for something unnecessary, while the contractor profits without addressing a real need, and that's rent-seeking. Once Congress approves funding for the fighter jet program, the bureaucracy becomes the implementer of the policy, so it's up to the Department of Defense, which is a massive government bureaucracy, to take that policy and make it happen. So they'll handle everything from drafting contracts to overseeing the construction to actually testing the jets. Even if the new fighter jets aren't a national security priority, the bureaucracy doesn't have a choice. They're there to implement the policies set by the elected officials, so their job is to follow orders, whether or not the project is truly necessary. Then let's talk about influence. Bureaucracies are supposed to operate neutrally, right? They're meant to focus on efficiency and fairness. But in reality, they're often pulled in a bunch of different directions by some powerful groups like lobbyists and politicians and interest groups. In our example, the defense contractor's lobbying efforts don't just stop at Congress. Politicians who support the fighter jet program might pressure the Department of Defense to prioritize it, even when other projects like improving cybersecurity are more urgent. And bureaucracies find they can't always push back against this kind of pressure, which means they can end up as just being tools for that rent seeking. And here's another layer. Bureaucracies operate under strict rules and procedures, which can make them inflexible. Once the fighter jet program is approved, the Department of Defense has to follow regulations for procurement and contracting and oversight. So even if the project turns out to be wasteful, bureaucracies can't just on their own cancel it. They're stuck in the system. So in cases like this, you'll sometimes see inefficiency baked into the process. And it's not because the bureaucracy is bad at their jobs. It's because the system itself is resistant to change. Now, here's an interesting twist. Bureaucracies also have to oversee these projects. So agencies within the Department of Defense might conduct audits or monitor the contractor's performance. And on paper, that sounds great, right? But in cases of rent seeking, that oversight can get really messy. The defense contractor might have powerful allies in Congress. Those allies could pressure the bureaucracy to go easy on audits or overlook inefficiencies. And suddenly, that watchdog role starts to get weaker. And the bureaucracy is caught between political and corporate interests. So here's why this matters. Bureaucracies are often the implementers of policies that are influenced by rent-seeking. They don't create that behavior, but they have to carry out the decisions that come from it. This means that they're vulnerable to outside pressure, either from politicians or from corporations. Their rigid rules can make it hard to adapt or to push back, and then they are often the ones blamed for inefficiency, even though the root cause came from somewhere else. So in the case of the fighter jet program, the defense contractor walks away with a big payday. The politicians get credit for creating jobs, and the bureaucracy is left holding the bag, trying to make it all work within a system that's not designed for flexibility or fairness. And this is where journalism can come in. So what's the role of journalism in a bureaucracy? It's a big and complicated relationship. Governments rely on journalists to disseminate information, to shape public opinion, and to build support for policies. This cooperative relationship can be strategic, with bureaucracies using the media to communicate with allies or with adversaries. So for example, during World War I, American journalists kind of acted as agents of the government. They weren't just reporting the news, they were actively serving as informants and publicity agents, helping rally public support for the war effort. But this kind of cooperation comes at a cost. During times like these, journalists may sacrifice independence for national interests. I saw this in person during the first Gulf War when the Defense Department was inviting journalists to ride with them into combat situations. I remember at that time I was working in a South Carolina town that had a large Air Force base. I was a reporter at the local newspaper, and my editor went to the Middle East as a guest of the Defense Department. Most of the reporting that he did was done from a military base in the United Arab Emirates where people from our town were staying, and he came back and did an entire special issue about his experience. The content and tone of that issue was super positive about the military and what they were doing, and I had questions. You know, given that he went with the military, did he see everything that would help him to create neutral judgments? And did he feel obligated to present the military efforts in a positive way because he had literally been dependent on them for food, shelter, and safety while he was reporting those stories? In cases like this, the press has sort of become an extension of the government, leaving the public to wonder, who's holding the government accountable when the watchdog becomes part of the system? Now, ideally, journalism is an independent watchdog, scrutinizing the things that bureaucracies do so that the public can hold them accountable. This is especially true in democracies, where transparency is essential to government by the people. And you can go back to episode 35 for more about that. You can take, like, automobile safety regulations. Scandals that investigative journalists reported on have been the catalyst for policy change. When government policies make businesses pay big costs but only provide small benefits to the public, journalists are often the ones who uncover those problems or that wrongdoing. And without journalists, government agencies might not be held responsible or pressured to make changes that help the public. The relationship between journalism and bureaucracy isn't always smooth. Bureaucracies often control the flow of information to protect their own interest. They may restrict access, they can strategically release information, or they might rely on public records officers who act as gatekeepers. There was a study examining these officers which revealed high levels of paternalism, where journalists' efforts to uncover and report on government activities were met with resistance. And this gatekeeping really challenges the press's ability to fulfill its watchdog role, especially in societies where transparency is expected. A few examples here. Although at the federal level, we do have open records laws that should mean it's possible to oversee the government doing its work, these records are controlled by underfunded and understaffed offices, which means that because they have to follow all those procedures as a bureaucracy, it can be agonizingly slow to get information. So much so that journalism groups like investigative reporters and editors actually have training workshops for members to learn how to possibly make the process more efficient. And sometimes political bodies just decide some information is no longer available. For example, President Trump declared that the records from the Department of Government Efficiency are under the Presidential Records Act, which makes it impossible to examine what that department does until 2034. Trump's White House, in his first term, also took White House visitor logs out of public inspection. This relationship is further complicated by the rise of sophisticated methods to manage the news. So, for example, in U.S. foreign relations, presidential administrations have developed really advanced strategies to control media narratives, and journalists find themselves walking a really fine line between cooperating with government sources to access information and staying independent so that they can report objectively. And because they have this adversarial relationship, it leads to these accusations of bias, which in turn undermines public trust in both journalism and the government. Even access itself can be difficult when there's limited spaces and briefing rooms. Just in the past month, legacy news outlets like TV networks and the New York Times were pushed out of Pentagon offices, and the Associated Press was denied White House access because they refused to refer to a body of water by a name and signed by an Inauguration Day executive order. Journalism's role as a check on power becomes even more complex when you're dealing with intelligence agencies. A study of media intelligence agency relations revealed a really delicate balance. Journalists investigating intelligence agencies often come up against security and national security secrecy concerns. And it's a balance to provide the public with critical information without harming those national interests. And agencies take advantage of this. So they will sometimes call things national security issues when really they're just inconvenient truths. Similarly, in the case of the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry, journalism plays such an important role in exposing the potential capture of regulatory agencies by the industries that they regulate. These agencies often have a hostile relationship with the industries, and at the same time, they're trying to get support from the public. Journalistic investigations into these dynamics can reveal conflicts of interest, mismanagement, oversight failures, and these kind of things can help protect public health when they're reported on. Despite the challenges, journalism has an absolutely essential role in transparency. Journalists dig, they seek access to public records, they follow up on tips from whistleblowers, and they investigate government activities. Journalists shine a light on issues that might otherwise remain hidden. Media coverage of public scandals often drives policy changes, and those can benefit society. Stories can also bring public attention to bureaucratic failures, and this can make public opinion that pressures officials to act. However, the relationship definitely has flaws. Bureaucracies can manipulate information, and journalists under pressure to produce, engaging stories on tight deadlines might inadvertently hurt their own credibility. And as the media industry continues to collapse, journalists have an incentive to prioritize stories that attract more attention rather than those that are substantive, which kind of weakens their oversight role. When bureaucrats make it difficult to get information by just dragging out the process, they can sometimes now just run out the clock on journalists. And this tension can hurt the public's trust in journalism. It can hurt the public's trust in government. And honestly, I think we're seeing both now. So I've got one more little bit of critical thinking for you, truth seekers. I'm going to replay that short clip from the beginning.
We have this unelected, fourth unconstitutional branch of government, which is the bureaucracy, which has, in a lot of ways, currently more power than any elected representative. And this is not something that people want. And it does not match the will of the people. So it's just something we've got to fix. And then we've also got to address the deficit.
Is the U.S. a bureaucracy? Well, yeah, it is. There's a massive set of administrative departments, and they follow strict rules for hiring people and for doing their jobs. And members of that bureaucracy sign an oath when they start working for the government. It's actually in the U.S. Code of Laws, and it reads, I, and they state their name, do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that I will faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I'm about to enter, so help me God. I hope you paid attention and noticed that that oath is not to a person and it's not to the president. It's to the Constitution, which is the set of principles and working plans that the country's founded on. The Constitution says that the allocation of money and the establishment of portions of the government is the responsibility of the legislative branch, that's Congress. The executive, you know, the president, is in charge of administering or making happen the things that Congress decides. He's the head of that bureaucracy. Reporting on the struggle for power is a big and important job for journalists right now. Today, journalism continues to struggle with issues of transparency and access and bias, and bureaucracy is navigating the balance between secrecy and accountability. And that landscape is changing pretty fast. It's being shaped by new technologies, by political pressures, by the expectations of society. So whether you're reporting on intelligence agencies or exposing regulatory failures or covering foreign relations, journalism is still an essential force in checking bureaucratic power. Stay safe out there, truth seekers. See you next week.
Thanks for getting Unspun with me this week. Unspun is a production of me, Amanda Sturgill, and is a proud member of the MSW Media family of podcasts. Send me your thoughts and ideas about trickery in the news on Gmail at theunspunpodcast@gmail.com. I even write back. And find this episode's show notes and more information at theunspunpodcast.substack.com. Want to learn more and get smarter? Check out my book, Detecting Deception, Tools to Fight Fake News, which is available on Amazon or your favorite online bookseller. And until next time, stay sharp, everyone.
Hi, I'm Dan Dunn, the host of What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn, a show that mixes history, culture, politics, famous people, and booze, and strains it through the cognitive mesh of my sozzled gray matter. Join me each week as I take a lighthearted stroll through the consequential role that alcohol has played through the ages, and how it shaped key moments in history, quite literally changing the world. For instance, did you know that Thomas Jefferson started the first U.S. wine company in Virginia with investments from George Washington and Ben Franklin? It's true. And if you're wondering whose winery sits across the street from Jefferson's estate today, here's a hint. What's orange, president, and has a very good brain and the best people. I'll also tell you about new stuff to drink, trends, recipes, and other things that are good to know. And I'll chat up celebrities, along with the movers and shakers of the adult beverage world. And since this is a show about alcohol, I'd like to remind you that drinking can cause memory loss. Or even worse, memory loss. Where was I? Oh, right. Plugging my show. It's called What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn. It's fun, I promise. So come on, pull up a bar stool, and let's kick it.